This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
The first few weeks overwhelmed me because there were all these kids from different towns, Shrewsbury, Worcester, Sutton, Oxford, Milford, and Leominster, or as we say in Boston, Shrewsbury, Worcester, Sutton, Oxford, Milford, and Leominster. It was my first taste of the real world, and the real world didn't like me.
That's comedian Mike Birbiglia, who mines comedic gold from his painful life stories, many from his childhood in central Massachusetts. Like most comedians, Birbiglia struggled early on. But in recent years, he's won acclaim for his appearances on This American Life, The Moth, and his one-man off-Broadway show called Sleepwalk With Me. His new book with the same title comes out tomorrow. Mike Birbiglia sat down with Radio Boston, and I started by asking him about the pronunciation of his name.
I say it Birbiglia. You know, sometimes people come up to me and they'll be like, in Italy, it's pronounced Birbiglia. And I'm like, in America, you're annoying. That is the correct way. But we're Olive Garden Italian. We're not real Italian. So we say Birbiglia.
Mike, from the get-go in your book, you talk a lot about your parents, particularly your dad, who really was the kind of guy that thought if something in your life were embarrassing, you don't tell the story. He used to say hush a lot.
Hush. And don't tell anyone.
But you have made a professional career out of telling uncomfortable stories, which is exactly what your dad advised you not to do.
Yeah, and even in the last few years, he continues to give me that advice as though I haven't been doing it. He kind of turns a blind eye to it, which is fine. I mean, my parents are wildly supportive of everything that I do, but it just took them a while to understand what it is that I do.
You said that your father actually was disappointed at one point that you had become a comedian. He's a neurologist, I think.
Yeah. I think the line is my dad, you know, worked his whole life to send me to college so that I could learn stuff, and I didn't, and I got a job making fun of him in front of strangers.
And it sounds like he's pretty rich material.
Yeah, no, he is rich material because he's a very smart guy, but then he also kind of gets angry. Sometimes he's not even sure why. He'll be like, damn it, I'm eating pretzels. And we're all like, is he angry? Is he hungry? What is the emotion being expressed? You know, my whole life he was searching for the portable phone. He'd be like, where's the damn portable phone? And my mother's role in the household was to find the portable phone. When I was 15, they invented that pager button that locates the phone. I thought they'd get divorced, and then the divorce papers under reasoning, right? I found the phone. Damn it.
One of my favorite stories about your parents is that you thought you weren't very computer proficient until
I met my parents. Yeah.
And they discovered email, but one thing they didn't learn is that you really should not open attachments that come from strangers.
Yeah, that's a big one. They continue to do that, too. To anyone listening, you know, if you're not that computer savvy, don't open emails from strangers. They ended up with a porn virus that was so extreme. You know, it was just like it took over the desktop and the icons, and the guy who jumped out of the screen and was like, where's your daughter? You know, it was very invasive. You know, it was a very tricky week in the Birbiglia household because I think they were sort of suspicious of one another, that the other person had sort of ordered this application for the computer. We're always baffled by my parents and computers because we have to kind of talk them out of these kind of mythical email forwards and things. We have to say, you know, Mom, pepper is not poison, even though your friend Martha sent you an email that says it is. Obama's a secret Muslim. Those are very popular these days.
So you have the usual painful childhood stories, embarrassing and painful stories that we all do. But whereas many of us might try to suppress them, you've actually just come up with rich comic material.
And actually, you're right to say that I've exploited the painful stories instead of being ashamed of them. I was ashamed of them for many years. I will point that out. I mean, I'm 32 now, and there's actually kind of a rule of thumb when I was writing the book was, if the story wasn't painful, it usually wasn't that funny. And it wasn't that worth telling. You know, like, I think sometimes you read books and the author isn't kind of opening up enough, you know, nonfiction. You're like, tell me the real story.
So did comedy become your way to make things that were painful less painful? Or is that over-psychoanalyzing how you've been able to use your childhood as fodder for a career?
No, I think that's certainly a way to interpret it. Sure, yeah. I mean that's what comedy is for everybody. I mean, there's this great Joan Rivers documentary that's out right now called Piece of Work. If you have a chance to see it, it's fantastic. And at one point, she's telling a Helen Keller story or a joke on stage at a casino in Wisconsin, and this person, heckler, shouts out, "That's not funny. My daughter's blind." And she goes, "And my mother was deaf." And she goes, "And that's why it's comedy. That's why we're here. Because we're talking about things that are uncomfortable. That's what comedy is." And it made me well up and made me cry watching that, because it's very meaningful, I thought.
One of the book praise blurbs in your new book is by Seth Meyers, the head writer and host of Weekend Update Saturday Night Live. And he wrote this, which I thought was funny but also sort of revealing. He said, "Mike Birbiglia is a good friend of mine, but I'm still really happy when weird, bad things happen to him because I love hearing the stories." So people now cheer when crazy things happen to you.
I guess so, yeah. I had this crazy incident happen. It's not in this book, but it'll be in the next book. In my next one-man show I'm working on is actually called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, and I'm opening it off-Broadway this winter. And the main event story of that is about how I was in Los Angeles, completely true story, hit by a drunk driver while driving my car. I was T-boned. I was nearly killed, like inches from being killed, because it hit primarily the back seat of my car. Spun my car around. I thought, okay, I'm dead. No weight. I'm paralyzed. And then I heard nothing. And then I heard the other car skid out and drive away. And then in this very strange series of events, I was actually made to pay for the drunk driver's car. And I went to lawyers and private investigators, and I tried to kind of make it right, you know, and then I had to kind of give up on the idea of being right. And that was something that was so painful when it happened. And actually my lawyer, who I've worked with for a lot of years, did point out to me on several occasions, I guarantee you, you will tell this story on stage someday.
So even the very worst things.
Yeah, and it was so funny because when I was in the moment, in the middle of it, I was just like, "No, I won't." You know, so mad. Well, I will never talk about this. I'm furious.
Do you ever feel that you have this? There's this expectation of you that you'll be funny, and it's hard to live up to?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, certainly, like socially, I have to deflate expectations immediately when I meet someone. I have to go the other way and be, you know, very straight and serious.
Is that because there's an onstage version of you and then a real version of you?
I don't think so. It's very close. I mean, people who know me well have commented that my onstage and offstage is very close and almost the same. But this is the distinction. When you're on stage, you're performing something that you've prepared over years. You've prepared your hour of the smartest, funniest things you've ever said and thought of in your entire life. You can't do that socially. You can't like say, "Oh, well, it's a pleasure to meet you, and here is an hour of the funniest things I've ever thought of." I mean, who does that? It's so obnoxious.
Maybe the fact that you're sort of a similar character on stage and off is that you spend a lot of your time on stage talking about yourself. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the earlier years of your career, you used other material. You had a piece on Cookie Monster and A-Team and Teletubbies. Yeah. And it was very funny, but you've shifted now to making your life your material. Why did that happen?
That's true. Yeah, I was actually given a piece of advice by my first manager, who was the late Lucian Hold, his name was, and he was the talent booker for the comic strip comedy club in New York in the 70s and 80s, all the way till he passed away in like 2003. He one time said to me, he said, "You know, if you write about yourself, no one can steal that material." And it's true, you know. The more you talk about this kind of common domain kind of topics, the more likely someone's done it.
Do you think there was a certain stage in your career where you realized that? There was a moment when you thought, I need to look at my own life because I have great stuff here? Or was that much more of a gradual process?
Well, early in my career, you know, and I think everybody does this with it, in whatever art form or whatever occupation they're in, I was just kind of copying what other people did who I admired. You know, I was copying Stephen Wright and Mitch Hedberg and Dave Attell and all these guys, not their material, but their style, you know. And at a certain point, I was given the opportunity, like, for example, I was on The Moth. I was asked to do The Moth storytelling series in New York and a few other storytelling shows. And it was, first of all, it was really hard to do because the first time you tell a personal story on stage, there's an immense amount of judgment that you feel. You know, if you're in a play or a movie, if people don't like it, they can go, well, we didn't like the set or the costumes. But with stand-up comedy or storytelling, if people don't like it, they're basically saying, we don't like you, you know, your personality. You know, at least that's how it feels. So it was really hard. But then when I did it, I actually had this moment of like, I'm actually better than this than I am at just joke storytelling.
Why?
But I don't know. I think, you know, my mom's Irish. She has storytelling in her genes. It's a storytelling culture. She's very funny. I mean, the way I portray her in the book is really kind of silly. You know, like I'll tell, you know, then this is a true story. Like I had my mom fax me something once and she called me up and said, could you fax that back? That's my only copy. That actually happened. But
you also have this funny story about how she's Catholic and mm-hmm. she really didn't like to swear.
Yep.
So she had this expression.
Yeah, she would say, like fun. Her way of saying, like hell, because for Catholics, hell is fun. That's my theory on like fun. But yeah, my mom and I are very close, and I feel like I learned comedy from my mom in a sense that she's very similar to me, is very sort of absent-minded and sometimes kind of says the wrong thing and is haphazard sometimes in her approach to things, occasionally inept in various areas. I'm saying this lovingly, of course, but this is the key thing, is that she has a sense of humor about it. She can laugh at herself. I think that's kind of the key to comedy, is kind of owning the narrative of your own comedy.
Your mom and dad are, as we've talked about, they're material for a good amount of your book. Now, in your introduction, you actually beg your mom and dad not to read the chapters about themselves.
Yeah.
I assume they've given you some feedback on this book.
They have not read the book, as I understand it. I don't know. I'm not sure if they have.
Have you made sure they haven't been able to get copies?
No. I haven't kept it from them, but I you know, the dedication is to my parents, Vincent and Mary Jean. If it weren't for your support of my many delusions, I wouldn't have been able to write this book. Also, don't read the chapters about yourselves. Also, I love you. And I read that to them. I read them that this summer. It's their choice whether or not they read the book. I don't know if they will.
Are you truly hoping they won't? Would you cringe a little?
I'd prefer if they wouldn't. I mean, I talked to them the other night. They were going to come and be supportive and come to my show at the Wilbur Theater. And I said, you don't have to do that. Like, you can see the, you know, when the material is all staged in New York and we're running off Broadway, you can come see it then. And my dad was happy to get that opportunity to be disinvited, because he was like, that's what we thought. So
do you think if they did go, you'd be able to do all your material?
Yeah. I mean, my mom saw the one-man show of Sleepwalk With Me, which ran off Broadway in New York for about 8 months last year, and that was tough, but fine. You know, it worked out fine, and that was actually great, because I brought my mom to town because I was on The View. I was on that, and that, and taking your mom to The View is like, it's like mom fantasy camp, and I said to Joy Behar, I said, do you mind if I introduce you to my mom? And she goes, am I her favorite? As though they're the Beatles, you know. And I go, yeah, you're her favorite. And she was so sweet to my mom. And Joy said to my mom, she goes, how did you like Mike's show last night? Because Joy had been there too. And my mom goes, I liked it, but some of this stuff was so personal. And Joy said, well, that's the best kind of comedy. So it was like kind of like getting a doctor's note from Joey Behar to my mom saying it's okay for me to be a comedian.
You just referenced your off-Broadway show.
Yes.
Sleepwalk With Me.
Yes.
So as a stand-up comedian, you're obviously accustomed to being on stage. But did you find the experience of Sleepwalk With Me doing off-Broadway different than doing stand-up?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because once you lock in the script, you know, it gets reviewed by 40 different publications, and you're doing a run of a show, and you really do have to stick to the script. As opposed to when I'm playing comedy clubs or concert halls as a stand-up comedian, I can change the script on the stage as I go.
So do you feel restrained and not to be able to just riff or do improv?
Absolutely. But then the freeing aspect of it is that I'd have to find the improvisations in the performance itself. And so you'd find things each night and you'd go, oh, well, instead of, you know, like this, I did this bit about how, like, I was living with my girlfriend Abby shortly after college, and I started seeing there were these two shows that kept popping up on our TiVo, and one of them was called Wedding Story, and one of them was called Baby Story, and they're not the most exciting depictions of weddings. It's always these two people whose names have some kind of alliteration, like Tommy and Tammy, and they'll be like, Tommy, what's your favorite thing about Tammy? And Tommy would be like, I always thought Tammy was beautiful on the outside, and then I got to know her and saw that she was also beautiful on the inside. Tammy, what's your favorite thing about Tommy? I didn't know what Prince Charming was until I met Tommy, and now I know what Prince Charming is. So that's Wedding Story. And so that was one of those things that were like, you know, night to night, like who was Tommy and who was Tammy would change. And I would do different voices and sometimes like evoke people who I'd gone to college with, you know.
Your comedy career now it's going pretty well. I mean, you've had several specials on Comedy Central.
Yeah.
You've had these best-selling comedy CDs. You did your off-Broadway show. You've appeared on Letterman and Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Kimmel. But it was not always that way.
No. that's pretty, basically most of the book covers the leaner years of it. Yeah, being a comedian is that it's not easy, and it's you know, you get placed in situations that are not exactly conducive to comedy. I mean, one time I showed up and they had me performing at a college in the center of a walkathon for lupus, and I had to kind of stand in the center of a gymnasium all night walkathon around the perimeter, and I had to kind of chase people like an oscillating desk fan blowing humor. And the guy who booked me looked me in the eye and he goes, I know it's not ideal. And he was right.
Although you talked about having these 5-minute slots at 3 o'clock in the morning doing comedy gigs, not even at comedy clubs, but in hotel lobbies.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you were living in Queens at the time. You temped during the day.
Yeah.
But then you would perform in New York City. You'd drive to nearby cities for gigs.
Yeah.
But yet you somehow seemed drawn to that kind of life.
Yeah, it is a strange thing. I mean, I moved, you know, when I was a kid, my parents moved from Shrewsbury to Cape Cod, and I switched schools a bunch. I think there's something maybe that I was drawn to. I don't know.
Do you miss it, or is it more just you miss it as far as the nostalgia and you're quite happy to be where you are now rather than doing those 3 a.m. hotel lobby gigs?
I don't miss it. Actually, the thing that I like most about my life now as a touring comedian is that people come to see me on purpose. I mean, that's the thing that's really hard when you're starting out is people aren't coming to see Mike Birbiglia. They're coming to see a, quote, comedy night. And that's hard because, like, if you think about, like, music, you never see, you know, tonight, music. You know, it's such a wide genre to say just comedy night. It's like you could, if it said music, that could be like death metal or choir, you know. In comedy, there are just as many gradations of in terms of genres. And you know, people didn't want to see kind of a soft-spoken storyteller sometimes. They wanted to see like an insult comic. Guys walk on stage and they're like, nice shirt, loser. And people are like, it's so true. His shirt does suck. I'm from Jersey. This guy's a genius.
You had gotten to a point where you talked in your book about you thought at least maybe I can be a middle act.
Yeah, that was like, that's what I perceived as the way to have a comedy be my job. It's because in comedy clubs, this is the structure of the show. And it doesn't make any sense. It's a the show opens with an MC who is the least experienced of anyone on the show, which really makes sense. You open the show with someone who has no idea what they're doing. Someone who started like a week ago, and they're essentially the chef in the kitchen. And then the MC does about 10 minutes of comedy and then brings up the middle act, which is a kind of an offensive way to describe a comedian, that they're middling. So
they're between the MC and the headliner.
Yes.
In fact, it may be your verb. Your book says there's a verb in the industry, to middle.
To middle. That's a real thing.
And you were hoping you could middle.
I was hoping I could middle. That was best case scenario, which is so offensive intrinsically because it's a synonym for the word mediocre. So you're like, I'm going to do some mediocre comedy right in the middle of the show. The middle does about 20 or 30 minutes, and then the headliner does probably about 45 minutes or an hour. But when you're an MC, you make between $0 and $300 a week. When you're a middle, you can make about $500 a week. And I was like, I can live on that for sure. So all I got to do is do that. And in the process of trying to get there, I ended up being a headliner.
So, Mike Birbiglia, do you feel like you have made it?
Yeah, I'm done. I'm retiring. I'm like Jay-Z and Eminem. I'm retiring.
I mean, great things have happened in your career. On the other hand, you do write about this part in your book where you had flown to L.A. for meetings.
Oh, yeah.
Meetings where you were convinced that a deal to get a sitcom was going to come through. You flew on your sister's frequent flyer miles.
Yeah.
The deal didn't come through.
Yeah, very common story.
So I wonder if you feel like you have made it, or what is your pinnacle?
Well, the landscape of comedy since I started has changed so much. I mean, it used to be in the 80s and 90s, this very clear-cut thing of if you were the most successful comedian, you would get a sitcom. And these days, I mean, I had a sitcom deal with CBS probably 3 years ago. We shot a pilot, and it was the Mike Birbiglia show, and it was a great cast. You know, Frances Conroy played my mom from 6 Feet Under, and Bob Odenkirk from Mr. Show played my brother, and it's just like a really exceptional group of people. We shot it, and it didn't get picked up for fall season when they premiere the sitcoms. And at the time, I thought that was terrible. And in retrospect, I'm so glad that happened, because it really wasn't. It wasn't me. It was CBS's version of me. And so in a way, I'm so glad that didn't work out, because actually, right after that, I decided to take Sleepwalk with Me, which was this one-man show that I'd worked on for years with my director, Seth Barish, and put it off Broadway and actually bring to it the production values that I'd seen CBS give to our pilot, which was so good. I mean, the thing that these networks are great at is producing stuff that really looks and feels nice, but maybe isn't always as specific as you might want it to be to the artist's voice. So I kind of did Sleepwalk with Me off Broadway, and that was the most fulfilling experience I've had in my whole career. But the thing that's interesting is, like, it used to be for comedians that the sitcom was the highest peak that you could reach, and my feeling is that sitcoms are going to kind of go away. And I, with the landscape right now, I mean, I don't know that there is a pinnacle in stand-up comedy anymore, nor will there be again.
Mike Birbiglia, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's so much fun.
Mike Birbiglia's new book, Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories, comes out tomorrow. And on Wednesday, he kicks off his book tour at Boston's Wilbur Theater. You can find more information about the event and about Mike Birbiglia at his website, birbigs.com. That's birbigs.com. Coming up after a break, we take two very different tours in Massachusetts. One back in history at the African Meeting House, and one into the future of museum audio guides at the DeCordova. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.